Cohen. The O'Donovan Russell Society is a cultural organization dedicated to raising awareness of the history of Irish republicanism in New York City. The society is named after Jeremiah O'Donovan Rosser, who was born in Roscarbery, County Cork in 1831. He was an Irish Fenian leader, and after serving numerous jail sentences, he was exiled to the United States. He settled in New York City and spent a number of years living in Brooklyn. He was the subject and wrote a number of articles for the Brooklyn Eagle newspaper. He moved to Staten Island and he died there in 1915 at the age of 83. And his body was taken back to Ireland, where he was buried in a huge funeral where Padraig Pearse gave the graveside oration. Our meetings take place every second Wednesday of every month here at Rocky Sullivan's. And in the past, our guest speakers have included Pete Hamill, Peter Quinn, and we've had music by Mary Courtney, Ray Collins, and Damian Dempsey. Membership is open to everyone, and you can sign up through the Rocky Sullivan website. Jim Cullen is a retired Brigadier General in the United States Army's Judge Advocates General's Court, and last served as the Chief Judge of the U.S. Army Court of Criminals Appeals. He has also served as Secretary Treasurer of the New York Construction and Industry Disaster Relief Fund. In 1980, Mr. Cullen became the founding president of the Brehon Law Society, working closely with the late Paul O'Dwyer and other civil rights attorneys on cases related to the conflict in the north of Ireland. He currently heads the Real Estate and Construction Department of Anderson Kill in Ulick. And Jim Cullen was part of a group of retired generals and admirals who lobbied the candidates during the recent presidential elections to put a halt to the use of torture in Iraq, Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo. And he was an invited guest in the Oval Office of the White House when President Obama signed the executive order to stop the use of torture in January 2009. Jim was the subject of a New York Times feature article by Jim Dwyer on January 29th, entitled "An Honor Guard Comes Out for Obama's Ban on Torture." He was recently honored by the Irish Law Students Association at the City University of New York School of Law for this work. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jim Cullen.
Well, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to come out to Red Hook. It's a what's happening place. I was just telling someone the last time I was out here was in 1965 when I took my tractor trailer driving exam just a few blocks from here. Things have changed somewhat. One little factoid that was left out in the description of Donovan Rosser. In February 1885, as he was coming back from his office on Chambers Street, where he was trying to raise money for folks in Ireland who needed the money, an English woman approached him, having made a prior appointment, on the pretext of making a donation. She took out a pistol and she shot him. Fortunately, it was just a serious flesh wound. The English government claimed that she was really mentally unbalanced and they had nothing to do with her. However, an English naval captain, and we have a naval captain with us here, but fortunately not English, made offer to take her back to England where she would be treated appropriately. Fortunately, the authorities in New York would have none of it, and she was kept as a guest of the New York government for a while. Just a little bit of a background. What I'd like to do tonight is to talk about the role of the rule of law and what happens when that rule is breached. And I think the best way to illustrate the impact of the breach of the rule of law is to talk about one particular experience in Northern Ireland, and then talk about some of the experiences that we as Americans witnessed here in this country when some political leaders and their political lawyer acolytes
sought to elevate expediency over the rule of law. It was a very cool, very windy evening on February 12, 1989, when a young family sat down to their Sunday dinner on Fort William Drive in a very nice neighborhood, a middle-class neighborhood in North Belfast. There was the young husband, his wife, and their three children, Michael, Kate, and John. At 7:25 p.m., two men smashed in the door, walked into the hallway, and called out, "We're here for the car." The young husband rose from the dinner table, walked to a glass door which separated the kitchen and the dining room from the main hallway, and he positioned himself between his family and the two intruders. He said, "No, you're here to take me out." With that, shots rang out through the glass door, and the young man fell to the floor. The two intruders, clad in black, with masks, and wearing camouflage jackets, burst through the glass door and shot the young man continuously as he lay on the floor. The kitchen floor was stone, and after one of the bullets passed through his body, it ricocheted off the floor and struck his wife in the ankle. Those are the cold, plain facts that describe the murder of Pat Finucane. Pat was only 39 when he was murdered, and although he was still quite young, he had already built a reputation as a resourceful and courageous lawyer. He took on clients who were principally nationalists, but he also represented loyalists. And he represented these people in a period when fewer and fewer lawyers in Northern Ireland were willing to represent these kind of clients charged with political offenses, because more and more the lawyers were receiving threats from the police and from other government agencies. But Pat was not intimidated. He challenged in the courts and through the law the unionist power establishment and the methods employed by British military intelligence and the political police, the special branch. Pat fought with a very potent weapon, the law. Fear of that weapon and the skill with which Pat wielded it led those who were in authority and who felt and believed with great accuracy that they had the license to commission the murder of Pat Finucane. The UDA claimed responsibility for Pat's murder. They were then the largest loyalist organization in Northern Ireland. They had been infiltrated in the early 70s by both British military intelligence and by the special branch. They were used to carry out acts on which the authorities did not want to leave their personal fingerprints. And when we look at the figures who were involved in Pat's murder in the UDA, you will see the extent of the control that the British government exercised over the UDA in complete disregard for the law or any accountability under the law. The head of intelligence for the UDA was Brian Nelson. He was in the British Army. He was a loyalist from the Shankill, and he was recruited to join the UDA to bring the UDA under tighter operational control of the British military. He was given intelligence when he was recruited for this role by British military intelligence and by the special branch, but particularly military intelligence. And with this trove of information, he quickly impressed the UDA with the names, current addresses, photographs, places of employment, and other details which they rarely had up to date. Recognizing this talent that fell into their laps, he was quickly appointed as head of intelligence and then later became director of operations. He was directly reporting to a unit called the Force Research Unit. It had been previously known as the 14th Military Intelligence Company. And when it got involved in some shoot-to-kill incidents that made it into the press, they were rebranded, the Force Research Unit. A nice bureaucratic-sounding name that would, of course, not lead you to believe what their actual job was. After word of Pat's murder broke out and the connections of collusion, they were rebranded again. Today they're called the Special Reconnaissance Regiment, and they've been enlarged. At any rate, the Force Research Unit in turn reported to a task coordinating group. The task coordinating group consisted of the head of Special Branch and three senior military officials in Northern Ireland. The task coordinating group in turn reported to the Joint Intelligence Committee in London. The Joint Intelligence Committee was populated by senior intelligence officials, members of the cabinet, and general officer commanding British forces. Its meetings was in that period often chaired by the Prime Minister, Mrs. Thatcher. The UDA man who supplied weapons to kill Pat was William Stobie. William Stobie had also been in the British Army, in his case for 12 years. He was trained as an armorer, and in the Army, an armorer has the job of fixing weapons, storing special weapons and fixing them. Bill Stobie ran up a tab at a loyalist drinking club, and they offered him a deal. They would either beat him badly, or he could work for them. He chose the latter. And he eventually became head quartermaster for the UDA in North Belfast. Almost immediately after he took the job as their quartermaster, Special Branch recruited him as an agent. I met William Stobie secretly, and it was at a point in time after Pat's murder, some years after Pat's murder, when the details started to break loose. He wisely formed the opinion that they might try to get rid of him as an inconvenient witness. He was an alcoholic, and he had his weaknesses, but he was very street smart. They tried to shoot him once before and then claimed it was a mistake when the shooting did not accomplish its end. So when he spoke to me, he wanted to go to Canada. He wanted enough money to start over a new life with his girlfriend and his mother. And during the course of that meeting in a hotel room with his lawyer and with a very well-known newspaper editor, he recounted the whole tale of how in the week before Pat's murder, he was called and asked to supply the weapons, two pistols, the following Sunday morning. And he was told only that the target was a high-ranking Republican in North Belfast. He wasn't given the name. He immediately reported to his Special Branch handlers what he had been told. Later in the week on Friday, he called them again. And they said, that's fine, we have everything under control. He picked up the weapons that Sunday morning, and he brought them to the Loyalist Drinking Club, where he was to turn over the weapons to the killers. He told me that when he walked in, he knew things were serious, because the killers, whom he knew well, were serious drinking guys. And that morning, all they had was orange juice on the bar. After he turned over the weapons, he left, and as he walked out, he saw one of his handlers sitting in an unmarked car across the street, and he naturally assumed they were going to follow the killers. Instead, when the killers got into their car, the Special Branch handler just did a U-turn and drove off in the opposite direction. A third figure in the UDA was Tommy Tucker Little. He was commander of the UDA in West Belfast at this time. And he told others, shortly before his own death, that Pat's murder had been commissioned by two upper mid-level special branch men. Tommy Little was another special branch agent. An investigation into Pat's murder was conducted by two policemen who were upstanding, honorable people. They weren't in the special branch. They belonged to what is called the Criminal Investigation Division, or CID. Both of them were of unionist background. One was Detective Sergeant Johnston Brown, excuse me, or Jaunty Brown as he was known, and his partner, Trevor McElrath. During the course of their investigation into who killed Pat, their lives were threatened on a number of occasions, and the threats were so serious that Trevor McElrath eventually suffered a breakdown. Johnston Brown said that during this whole period, they feared the special branch. They, the policemen, feared the special branch far more than they ever feared the IRA. About 18 months after Pat's murder, they obtained a confession surreptitiously, which they taped, of one of the men who committed the murder. They were directed to hand over the tape to Special Branch. When they checked on it a little later, the tape had been substituted. The confession was no longer there in its original form. Sir John Stevens, who was later to become the United Kingdom's top policeman, was directed to conduct investigations into allegations of collusion. He conducted three investigations over 14 years. The last investigation focused on Pat's murder. They quickly discovered Brian Nelson's role. And the day before they were going to bring Brian Nelson in and formally charge him, Brian Nelson was tipped off and fled the country. When Sir John Stevens' team, all of whom were from, as the Brits quaintly put it, the mainland, namely England, because they knew they could not trust the RUC, when they returned to their facility in what was then the most secure joint military and police facility in Northern Ireland, they had been given a separate building. When they returned to the building, it was ablaze. The fire alarms had been severed, the motion detectors had been severed, the telephone lines had been severed. All of the evidence had been stored in that building. Fortunately, Sir John Stevens had already got an inkling of what the RUC was like because of his earlier investigations. And they had made copies of most, although not all, of the evidence and had it secretly sent to England 2 weeks previously. Short time later, the British government, in response to these investigations, and they would never permit, the UK government would never permit, by the way, Sir John to give reports on his investigations. Eventually, he was allowed to give a very brief and highly redacted summary of the third investigation. But that was sufficient to require the British government to appoint Peter Corey, a justice, a retired justice of the Canadian Supreme Court, to conduct the investigation. And they promised both the Irish government and the world at large that if Judge Corey found evidence of collusion in Pat's killing or in any of five other killings he was asked to take a look at, they would convene an independent public inquiry. Well, Judge Corey, who was a bomber pilot in World War II, told me sometime later that he really thought the British government expected that he would die before he ever finished his investigation, or that at the very least it would take him many years because of his age. What they didn't realize is that Judge Corey in his 80s ran each morning, and he finished his investigation in 2 years, I think much to their disappointment. He made it very clear that there was evidence of collusion. Well, this was most unsettling. It was in 2004, late spring, when another event I'm going to talk about briefly in a moment occurred. The British government rushed through that recess of the summer legislation to replace the Tribunal's Inquiry Act of 1921, which had served the British people for 84 years whenever there was a crisis in the confidence of the government. We call them scandals here. All of a sudden, it was necessary to change a statute that was on the books for 84 years. And what did the new legislation look like that they pushed through? A minister of government was given the task of appointing any inquiry panel. No judge could be trusted to appoint, clearly, an inquiry panel. Sorry, judge. The inquiry could only look into such things, which the Brits call terms of reference, as they were directed to look into by that minister. The minister could withhold from the inquiry or direct it not to reveal evidence that in the minister's opinion felt would not be in the national interest to disclose. The minister would also control funding for the inquiry and could pull that funding at any time he was so persuaded. Further, he could suspend the inquiry at any time he thought it would be necessary. Clearly, this was a charade, and the family refused to participate in it. Now, we know that no government is eager to disclose its scandals, its errors, never mind its participation in murder. Our government was not particularly eager to talk about Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, nor our participation in the elimination of President Allende in Chile. But we're brought back to the core question. What should it take to convince a citizen, or as the British so quaintly put it, a subject, to trust the government to which they owe an allegiance? That is a question that has preoccupied many good people, including Lord John Stevens, John Storker, and Sergeant Jaunty Brown. And we have to ask, have the special branch men and British military intelligence, who exercised their licenses to commission murder, departed from the scene, or are they still waiting in the wings? We don't know, because there's never been an investigation. Many of the key actors and witnesses in Pat's murder are already dead. Some were murdered. William Stobie was murdered shortly after he met with me. Others died under mysterious circumstances, like Brian Nelson. Delay is the most effective tool in any cover-up. No one should be above the law. There must be accountability if trust is to be restored. The British government has demonstrated, by changing the law and by refusing to have a truly independent inquiry, that it is no more prepared today to account for its complicity than it was when it allowed special branch and British military intelligence to destroy evidence of that complicity. And the ultimate question, of course, this leads us to, is whether there will be a truly independent inquiry in Pat's case is subsumed in the debate over the role of the rule of law, and whether it'll prevail or it'll fail against arguments of state expediency. The same debate is taking shape in the United States, as those of us who would hold to account the architects of the torture policies and violations of the Geneva Conventions are met with arguments that accountability would be divisive and distract from other national priorities. In late April 2004, photos of abuse of detainees shocked Americans as they shocked people throughout the world. At first, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said what we were seeing was simply the products of a few bad apples. I certainly wanted to believe that. I knew it was certainly possible. If you take the demographic slice of males age 18 to 26, we know that in the military, 5 to 10% of them are always prepared to engage in some wrongdoing if there's a breakdown in military discipline. And I assumed, because I knew the unit quite well, that there was a failure of command discipline, of command leadership. But then patterns of abuse began to emerge at Guantanamo and at Bagram in Afghanistan. And I think prosecutors will realize that when you see patterns of misconduct, coincidence is rarely a credible explanation. We do need to recall that the events at Abu Ghraib were revealed by a soldier, disgusted by what he saw. We also have to keep in mind that it was agents of the Naval Criminal Investigative Service who went to the top and told what was going on at Guantanamo. They went right to the Navy General Counsel, Alberto Moro, who was probably the only political lawyer to come out of this whole mess with his integrity intact. Commanders recognize certainly the damages these abuses caused to their missions and to the institutional values of the military and the country that they served. The moral challenges that we face and reprehensible conduct by enemies, such as Al-Qaeda, are not new to the American experience. George Washington gave our military its standard. After the Battle of New York in September 1775, the British captured over 2,500 Americans, and they imprisoned them partially in two old sugar refinery warehouses close to where present-day City Hall is. But the bulk of them were put on rotting ship hulks close to where the Brooklyn Navy Yard is today. Of those 2,500 men who were imprisoned, less than 800 were still alive about a year and a half later. 7 months later, in February of 1777, there was a minor skirmish out in Metuchen, New Jersey. 7 Americans were captured in that skirmish. Within moments after their capture, they were brutally beaten to death, clubbed to death by their British captors. Word reached Washington of what was happening in New York City, and it reached him of what was happening in Metuchen. Word also reached Congress. And there were those in Congress who were understandably furious and understandably demanded retribution. The law of war, as it was then understood, although not termed that, would have allowed retribution, certainly equal to the measure of what the Brits had done to our soldiers. But Washington said no. His words were, with respect to the British soldiers that the Americans had captured, he said, "Treat them with humanity and let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British in their treatment of our unfortunate brethren who have fallen into their hands." General Washington directed that British prisoners be afforded food, housing, and medical care in no respect inferior to that supplied to Americans, soldiers. His decision proved to be the wiser one. Because we took no retaliation and because we treated the British prisoners appropriately, they surrendered to us at Saratoga, over 6,600 of them, and then Cornwallis surrendered to us at Yorktown. Insurgencies and guerrilla warfare are not new. The rules we apply in warfare are not new. When we fought the insurgents in the Philippines, the Americans court-martialed an American general, General Smith, who engaged in war crimes, including waterboarding of Filipino prisoners. In World War II, when we were fighting an enemy far more threatening and lethal than the characters we're fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq. General Eisenhower issued very strict directives that the Americans were going to comply with the predecessors to the Geneva Conventions. No political leader at that time sought to undermine his command guidance or his directives, and they certainly did not in any way try to contradict it. The results are telling. Prisoners taken on the Western Front, that is, prisoners taken by Americans, German prisoners, Italian prisoners, and American prisoners taken by the Germans, survived the war. It's only about less than 3% fatality rate. When you contrast that with the experience on the Eastern Front, where neither side observed international law or the predecessors to the Geneva Conventions, for reasons chillingly similar to those advanced by Mr. Cheney and his acolytes, there was over a 70% fatality rate. So if anyone needs empirical evidence, we have it. Now, it's not to say that all sides adhere to the law at all times. The Germans murdered American prisoners at Malmedy in the Battle of the Bulge, the SS unit. Americans tortured German submariners outside of Washington. But by and large, both sides complied with the rule of law. We have to be very careful. When we're told that old rules no longer apply, we must be careful that our own values and discipline, which underwrote those rules, are not also put aside. And we're not just talking about making prisoners uncomfortable or dumping water on them. In a study done by a highly respected human rights organization called Human Rights First, and a study you can get online, it's called Command Responsibility, they investigated deaths in our Defense Department detention facilities between August 2002 and December 2005. There were 98 deaths during that period. Of those, DOD classified 34 of them as murders, 8 of them involving death directly from torture. There was another 11 where homicides were strongly suspected at the time and were being investigated. The balance took place early in the war, particularly in Afghanistan, and there were no investigations or no serious investigations. So we're not just talking about making people uncomfortable. And I think no matter what side a person is on the debate over torture, we can all agree that a dead detainee does not give you intelligence. Ultimately, when you take somebody and you capture them, the first thing you're looking for is immediately available intelligence for your own force protection. You want to try to find out what the situation is on the ground. Under Army doctrine, you are then directed at the unit level to pass those people up, typically to brigade level, where is the first place you're going to have a military intelligence officer who has a bigger picture, and he interrogates them further. And then they're passed up to division and so on. We know through hard experience gained mostly at the end of World War II when we questioned Nazi prisoners that you will get information from people when they want to tell you something. Now, I spoke to one older man who was questioning, interrogating some of the Nazis, some senior Nazis, and he told me that some of his best information came after he had arranged for them to be taken out of the cell and into a garden courtyard where he set up a chess table. They laid out, as a result of that experience, 16 approved methods of interrogation. Any experienced detective would recognize all of those 16 techniques. None of them involve use of fists. As one of my colleagues who was a combatant commander, former head of the infantry school, he was in charge of training the Iraqi army, said one day, torture is the tool of the lazy the stupid and the incompetent. And I don't think I could improve upon that. How did we get to where we were? Mr. Cheney, on September 16th, 2001, began to set the tone. He asserted that the United States was going to have to work, quote, on the dark side. And it was going to be vital for us to use any means at our disposal to achieve our ends. I can tell you that the 19-year-old soldier out in the field heard that. It was a message that dropped like a stone into water. And those commanders in the field could not control the ripples that spread out from that message. Try to stop a ripple. You can't. Alberto Gonzalez, who was then the White House counsel, was more specific. In a January 2002 memo, he said that the Geneva Conventions and their restriction on questioning detainees were quaint and irrelevant. In August 2002, Jay Bybee, who then headed the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, a formerly highly respected position, redefined torture as an act that only occurs when the level of pain and suffering is so severe that death, organ failure, and permanent damage resulting in a loss of a significant bodily function will occur. Now, I have a limited imagination. I'm sure many of you have much better imaginations than I have. And I'm sure all of you could think of things to do that wouldn't result in death or organ failure that we could all agree was nevertheless torture. Another active architect of the administration, with whom I've had words on a stage, John Yoo, who worked in the Office of Legal Counsel, knew that what they had in mind, these techniques, could result in domestic prosecution under the War Crimes Act if circumstances changed. And it's basically a crime under our Domestic War Crimes Act to commit a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions. So he drafted a memo that was really a lawyer's defense memo. And what he was putting forward, what were the defenses going to be if a prosecution was ever mounted? And what could they do now to make sure that there was not a successful prosecution? And you could sort of summarize his positions in three parts. One, he said, well, the Geneva Convention should not apply because the Taliban in Afghanistan was a failed state. That was the same arguments that the Nazis used against the Soviets. But it also is curious because usually in a war, there's one loser, and the loser is almost by definition a failed state. Now, Mr. Yu, having never been in the military, didn't particularly care about the dilemma of the soldier who doesn't yet know whether he's on the losing or the winning side and what happens to him when he's captured. His second point was that the president could suspend the Geneva Conventions at any time. And if you suspended the conventions, well, then you lost the jurisdictional predicate to a prosecution under the War Crimes Act. His third ground was the most chilling of all. There he said, the president, when acting in his role as commander-in-chief, is essentially not subject to the constraints of the law. Now, when you distill the arguments advanced in favor of torture or enhanced interrogation techniques, you really see the same process that brought the British government to the use of its techniques in Northern Ireland. Expediency and short-term goals, the need to win right now, before the next election, is what drives the mentality, instead of realizing the damage that it could do to your long-term goals, and much more importantly, what damage does it do to the rule of law? There are practical reasons, quite apart from the legal and moral reasons, not to engage in torture or state-sponsored terrorism. Torture and other abuse makes it far more difficult to gather intelligence from the population that you need to draw that intelligence. No one is so naive as to believe that if we comply with the rule of law that psychopaths in Al-Qaeda is going to comply. That's not the point. What you need to do is to reach the people among whom Al-Qaeda swims. You must depend upon that housewife, that cab driver, that fruit vendor, any person who is sick and tired of the nihilism of the terrorist to bring you information. And they will, as long as you do not engage in the kind of practices that we saw at Abu Ghraib. You lose the support of your allies. Even the Brits, with their history and what they did at Long Kesh in the early 70s, with the five techniques that they brought from the Adon in Cyprus, would not sit in Bagram once they realized what we were doing. Torture does not produce reliable intelligence. There are two pools of people who are victims of torture. There's the much larger pool in which I'm sure most of us, and including myself, would find ourselves. And that is, at a certain point, you're going to tell that torturer whatever you think he wants to hear to stop the torture. It has nothing to do with the truth. And that's the first problem. There's a much smaller group who have been trained in counterinterrogation techniques. They're often ideologues. They realize they may be captured, and it's standard operating procedure to have a cooked story ready for the interrogators to buy time. In Vietnam, you knew that if you relied on that kind of information, which the South Vietnamese would occasionally extract, you were probably going to walk your unit into an ambush. We saw examples of what happened to us on a strategic level when we relied on information provided by a man we picked up in Afghanistan, a goat named Al-Libi. He had been Taliban. He had a falling out with the Taliban. I suspect it was over a poppy field. Whatever the reason, he was giving us good, solid, reliable information that was of both tactical use to our people on the ground and was of use to the FBI cell that we had at Bagram. George Tenet won the food fight at this same time to take the lead on questioning high-value detainees. And seeing bureaucratic food fights, I'm sure he saw some budget dollars behind it. At any rate, CIA was brought in to take Al-Libi out. Now, the CIA is often lost in the debate, have no experience in interrogations. That was never their mission. They have a very small cell, and it's usually somebody tasked from the FBI when they have suspected counterintelligence problems within the agency. But nothing in their whole history or remit train them for intelligence. They're very good at questioning people over a few martinis at a cocktail party at an embassy. That's not an interrogation. But all of a sudden, they were parachuted in, grabbed Al-Libi, gave him a going over, put him on a flight to Cairo, Egypt. Well, Al-Libi was not stupid. He knew what these guys wanted to hear, and he said, oh yes, of course there were ties between Saddam Hussein and the Taliban. Of course there was ties. This is exactly what they wanted to hear. They piped it up to George Tenet, who then briefed Colin Powell as the only credible member of the administration on a worldwide plane. Colin Powell, having the usual distrust of the CIA that pervades the military, wanted to go over to CIA headquarters in Langley, which he did with his chief of staff, whom I know. They spent two nights there. They wanted to see validation of that intelligence. And validation in the military means two things. It's like a matrix. Number one, you want to see how many sources gave you the same information. The more sources saying the same thing, the more likely the information is to be valid. Second measure on the matrix, has this person given you reliable information previously? When General Powell asked about the validation standard, they assured him it was cross-validated. All a total lie. This guy Al-Libi had never given us information. Well, that's wrong. He had given us local tactical information, but there was no cross-validation from other sources. As soon as Al-Libi got back to Afghanistan, he recanted everything, but the damage had already been done. General Powell, the ultimately honorable man, had placed his personal credibility on the line at the UN to explain why we were going into Iraq. That was a strategic trap into which we fell of our own making. The alienation caused by torture techniques, especially when they're applied indiscriminately and to innocent people, is the most effective recruiting tool we can give our enemy. Certainly the Brits found that out after what they did in Operation Motorman. The tortured and humiliated prisoner will be an enemy, regardless of what he is before you brought him in. But you've now leveraged that because his family, his clan, his neighbors are now enemies. And we still don't have good information. Torture fundamentally undermines military discipline. When a commander either authorizes or winks at a violation of the law, he's lost control over that unit. Because the next time he's out and he orders one of his soldiers to do something that is perfectly legal, that soldier can blackmail him. We can't have that. We're concerned, too, about the impact of torture on the torturer. It's been said that there are two victims in that room when torture occurs. When we take young men and women and put them in the military, we think of an implied covenant with their parents, with their spouses, with their families. And in that covenant, we cannot guarantee to return them whole in body. But if they do come home, we promise to return them, we should return them as better citizens. They're no longer an individual. They've been trained to look out for their buddies, to look out for their unit, to realize that they are sacrificing for something larger than themselves, for their country and for their military. We ask enough of our young servicemen and women. We should never ask them to compromise their honor and add to their burden. Lastly, this is not the last war we're going to fight. We must never give our enemies, present or future, an excuse, a precedent, to do to our people who are going to be captured. And we are concerned about American prisoners of war who are not yet born. What we're doing today, and whether we correct it or we fail to correct it, is going to have a direct influence on how they're treated when they're taken prisoner. In summary, there are rules and accountability, even in the brutality of war. I'd be happy to take any questions. I think that's an excellent question, and I should say, as a preliminary comment, there's an affirmative duty under the Geneva Conventions to investigate any credible evidence indicating that there has been a war crime committed. I met with Eric Holder, our new Attorney General, several weeks before President Obama took office. We met also with Greg Craig, the White House counsel. They wanted to discuss this very issue. My take from Greg Craig was that he was very much inclined to conduct the necessary investigation to determine whether there were war crimes committed, that is, torture, because he knew about the affirmative obligation under the Geneva Conventions. And we're not talking about people at Abu Ghraib who are now sitting in prison. We're talking about who authorized what and under what circumstances. I think what has happened in the meantime is that the president, being very mindful that there are major initiatives that he is trying to get through, health care, immigration reform, pick your thing that we need to address in this country. He realizes that in that many respects, he doesn't have a majority because there are some Democrats he can't count on. And there is this right-wing lunatic fringe on the radio that have people convinced that if we close Guantanamo, terrorists are going to move in the next apartment to you. I think that they have people so rattled that they're pulling back. That debate is taking place not in our courtrooms, not in our investigative agencies where it belongs, but I think it's taking place on the public airwaves. I think that Mr. Cheney was actually quite brilliant when he brought the public debate forward, because he recognized that if you had more and more revelations, there'd be more and more calls for a special investigator to be appointed. And once matters get into the court system, they're out of political control. They will then take their course. I think he made a very astute judgment in saying, if I take this into the public arena and cast the argument that we were simply trying to protect America and doing what was necessary to guys who were prepared to cut people's heads off. Well, the guy down south and out Midwest and other places not close to here is gonna hear that argument and saying, yeah, he's right. So we're still at a very delicate time in that debate, but our legal obligations are clear. We know that from Nuremberg. After Mi Lai, I represented the chaplain in the Pierce Commission investigation after Mi Lai. We took our responsibility seriously then. The court-martial system addressed those who were alleged to have committed the wrongdoing, but we were far more worried in the military about whether there was a cover-up at that time. And General Pierce was directed to conduct an inquiry. He had been the superintendent at West Point, a man known throughout the military and in Washington for his unparalleled integrity. We wanted to get to the bottom of it because what we needed to do in that instance was to restore the confidence of the American people in their military, because no mother or father was going to send a child away to massacre villagers in some faraway places. That's not what we as Americans do. So General Pierce conducted an enormously comprehensive investigations, producing 4 telephone book size volumes on his findings, and also at the end of it summarized 12 lessons that we learned from what went on, which we then taught at the JAG school to all officers promoted to the rank of general. We handled our investigative duties then appropriately. I am hopeful that as this public debate matures and people have an opportunity to think further about the real values that are involved, we'll have our investigation.
What role, if any, do you think the international community might play in remedying the situation?
Well, I think there is a new sensitivity in Washington to international opinion, unlike what we just went through 8 years ago. Still the people that need to be reached in this, and we had occasion prior to the election, there's a group of retired generals and admirals who, with the assistance of Human Rights First, traveled throughout the South and through the Midwest to talk about these concerns. And you meet very good people out there who really care. They're good Americans. And they had only heard one side of the story. That is, there are terrorists out there trying to kill us, and we have to use all means at our disposal, the Cheney argument. But when you talk to people about what really is at stake, what's at stake for our own military, what happens to our national values, what precedent that we're creating now, what impact is that going to have on us in the future? These good people will listen. And that's why I think the public debate is very important. And certainly people from overseas should weigh in on that. intelligent voices, no matter what their origins, have the same validity. People will listen.
With regards to Abu Ghraib, you've mentioned, you broached the matter of the military and holding them accountable and the ripple effects of the acts that they carry out in Abu Ghraib. Titan and Cassie are two civilian contractors that were sent out to Abu Ghraib as linguists and as interrogators. How do you think that we should broach the matter of dealing with civilians, because they don't fall under the auspice of the Geneva Convention?
Well, they really are subject to the Geneva Conventions under both domestic law and international law. The responsibility of contractors was muddied. Not only in recent years, the law used to be that anyone traveling with the military was subject to court-martial if they violated local military regulations or created an offense or participated in an offense where normal civilian jurisdiction did not travel. And there's a whole legal history right from the Civil War about that, which I won't burden you with. That all became very vague during the Iraq and Afghanistan campaign. There was some clarity brought to the issue because the military does now have clarified jurisdiction over them. The military, quite frankly, is reluctant to exercise that jurisdiction. But unlike even when we were in Bosnia, where we had civilian contractors who were involved in white slavery of underage, seriously underage Slavic girls who had come to Bosnia. And these characters would hold their passports and they would sell these girls. $100 to $500 was the range. And when the military learned of it, they demanded prosecutions. Well, these guys were airlifted out of Bosnia, sent back, and the U.S. Attorney's Office was supposed to do something. It's the Eastern District of Virginia has jurisdiction. Did nothing. It's disgraceful. There's a change now where the Iraqi courts have been given jurisdiction for offenses. That's going to make it interesting. So that's going to be played out. At least now, we don't have the vacuum of jurisdiction that existed in the early part of Iraq. So now it becomes the willingness of the prosecutors. There's a huge backlog of cases down in Virginia from the last years of the Bush administration where they would complain in the prosecutor's office that they didn't have the forensic evidence from overseas. I'm not so sure about that. They would complain they didn't have witnesses, even though the military had the names and contact points for witnesses. You can draw your own conclusions about what was going on there.
The thing I don't understand about this whole thing, and I can't fathom, why was it so important to Dick Cheney, who obviously drove this, to Donald Rumsfeld, to Mr. Bush Sr., and these creeps who ran our government? Excuse me for saying that, but goddamn it, why was it so important?
Well, I think we have to draw a distinction.
Other than oil. Okay.
Well, that's a big thing.
Draw a distinction between the first Gulf War and the second one. I think the question you ask is on the minds of many, many Americans. And the answers are probably different depending on who you're talking about, whether it's Cheney, whether it's Rumsfeld, whether it was President Bush. But when you look at it as a realist, other than oil, what was there? Because if you had that cold and very, very capable British analysis that served the empire so well, you had a wonderful balance in the Middle East. You had the Iranians and the Iraqis each looking at one another. It was like two bullies in a bad neighborhood, and neither one would move. Now Saddam, we now realize, was puffing about weapons of mass destruction, not for our benefit, for the Iranians. So they didn't start in with him again because he was a hollow shell. He had no effective military, despite all the blustery, a lot of people, but no effective military. So why does one upset that balance? Why don't we let the two bullies in the neighborhood go at one another, or at least be looking over each other's shoulders? That's above my pay grade. I can't answer that.
What do you think about closing Guantanamo and what's going to happen with the trials of the detainees? And are we really in this here in New York City that they would come to the prisons here? I mean, it seems I'm not scared, right?
But they have your the apartment next to you booked, though. You realize that. No, that's if you look at the population down at Guantanamo, first of all, look at the number of people that went through Guantanamo. During the Bush administration, over 600 people were processed through and released. You know, Cheney and Rumsfeld were always telling us it was the worst of the worst. There were some bad guys there, but what happens? I know in Iraq, some of the people there are senior JAGs and military police, people I know very well. And one mid-level guy was let out at Abu Ghraib by mistake. Now, we were not yet used to the Arab names, and you know, it was like two Joe Smiths, and they let the wrong guy go. Well, you would have thought that the world came to an end. So what does somebody do after something like that? Well, you don't let anybody go. And in Afghanistan, unlike Iraq, you really had no place to put people that was secure. So, and they got the word, you're not releasing anybody if there's any question at all. When the infantry go in the battlefield, you try to pick up anybody who could be a direct threat to your troops. So you look out and you look at all the young males. Well, you don't want those guys behind you in case they're guerrillas or they're intelligence agents. So you pick them up. And the idea is that military intelligence gets sorted out who the farmer is and who the guy who's the real threat. And you let the farmer go back to his field. Well, when this bureaucratic block occurred, nobody wanted to make a decision to let the farmer back to his field. There was a conveyor belt. And since there was no place to stop the conveyor belt in Afghanistan, the end of the conveyor belt was Guantanamo. And even General Miller, who was not one of our most principled guys, complained that he was the commander down at Guantanamo, that they were sending him garbage. And he was using that term in describing the intelligence value of the people they were sending him. It was clear that some of them were so old and so young or so decrepit that these guys were clearly not a threat to anyone. And they weren't related to anybody who had any information. Rumsfeld at that point, when he finally came to grips with that these people, you know, really didn't know anything, did not want to authorize a mass release because this would contradict all of his statements about the worst of the worst. So they were directed to let them go in twos and threes beneath the media radar. As I say, over 600 were released. What you have left, I think, can be broken down into the truly worst of the worst. Most of the guys who fall into that category, say 14 or 18 of them, were the ones that the CIA were holding in the black prisons overseas. And when the press finally found out about the black prisons and they were no longer deniable, they brought him over to Guantanamo. These are the guys we got to focus on. Now, one of them was just brought up, I think, yesterday for a trial here in New York. The others, the real question is going to be whether the clowns in the CIA, and I don't mean to disparage them across the board, there are some very, very good CIA agents. And if time later, you know, if we're having a drink, I'll tell you about one of the terrific guys that they had. But largely, when they took them in and did some of the things to these detainees that they did, they may have made it difficult, if not impossible, to try them in a court, whether it's a military commission, a court-martial, or a court. So I think what they're trying to do now in those cases is to find, is there any collateral evidence out there that's not tied to the torture or the fruit of the poison tree, as we call it, that will allow prosecution of those individuals. So we'll put those to the side. We'll put the most difficult stuff to the side for a moment. At the opposite end of the spectrum, you have a lot of folks who were picked up by a mistake where they bit players. What's happened to them in the meantime? You know, when you start to dribble on yourself and forget where you parked the car in the morning, you're hardly a threat anymore. And some of these guys have been in, if they've had any intelligence information. Intelligence information has a very limited shelf life, and it depends how high up on the totem pole you are. But even if you're near the top of the totem pole, your intelligence value, you know, is it 6 months, is it a year? because obviously once somebody is captured, whatever they're involved in is changed. It's just routine. We would do the same thing. The guy who was down on the bottom, and maybe he was driving a car for somebody, well, what does he really know? So, and you got people over there who were just picked up. They were the residue of the Afghani guys who were brought over because there was no place else to put them. We're trying desperately to find other people to take them because they're not a threat to anybody. But how do you convince somebody to take someone that you have convinced to have been among the worst of the worst? You talk about a marketing challenge. So that's a problem, you know, and in some cases, the Chinese Uyghurs being the outstanding ones, everyone agrees, even the most rabid guys in the intelligence community, these fellows are no threats. They're a threat to the Chinese, but we can't send them back to China. Clearly, they would be tortured and worse. So what do you do with them? That's a problem. And the messes of our making. So how do we, we've even approached Ireland to take some of the Chinese Uyghurs. And they said, well, maybe we'll think about it. And that was before the economic collapse. In the middle, you have maybe the most challenging. These are the guys who would be threats if you release them. And ultimately, from a military point of view, you don't want somebody out there who's going to go back into the battlefield. Now, we make decisions every day of the week in this country when we release people that this man has sentenced over here. At some point, that sentence is up. And let's say Judge Ingram put away a drug dealer. Okay, he serves 20 years or whatever it is. I never did well in criminal law forces. But someday we release him. And he's back out. Do we take a chance when we let that guy back out on the street? Yeah, we do. We're a nation of law, and the sentence is supposed to reflect the severity of that guy's offense and his threat. So there's always some risk when you release some people, but then on the other hand, we have more certainty from intelligence sources that's not admissible in court that some guys are truly threats. This lead, now the law of war always was that you could hold a detainee, somebody you captured on the battlefield, for as long as he was a threat and as long as the war continued. That was very easy when you had conventional wars. War was over, then you released the guy, just like we did with the Germans after World War II. Most of them were out by 1947. It's much more difficult during a conventional war, during an unconventional war such as we have now. One of the cases that went up to the Supreme Court, there was a colloquy between Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and the Solicitor General. And I think that the government had that case won, except for the extreme position that the Bush administration directed the Solicitor General to take in that argument. Because when Sandra Day O'Connor asked him, well, how long would you propose holding this man? This is before they were going to try the guy. And she said, a year? Oh, yes. 10 years? Oh, yes. 50 years? Oh, yes. The government lost her vote because their position was so extreme. Now, that doesn't give you an answer. And there's a certain point in time when a dangerous guy is no longer effectively dangerous. But this has brought us into the whole discussion over administrative detention. Administrative detention under the law of war really didn't exist. It was simply under the law of war rule that you held a captive until the war was over, and then you returned him. That is probably going to occupy more airtime than the other two categories, the other two categories that we're holding down at Guantanamo. But certainly, as to the truly dangerous guys, we have supermax prisons in Ohio and Colorado that make even the inner detention cells at Guantanamo look like a country club. So all of this nonsense about bringing people to the United States and you're going to endanger people, a lot of nonsense.
Yeah, before you get back to the Pat Nugent's assassination, the rule of law.
Unfortunately, in Britain, there is no written constitution. The rule of law is whatever the parliament says it is. So if they change the rules for an inquiry, as they did, mm-hmm. They technically operate within the rule of law.
That's exactly the answer we got from, I got a letter from the British ambassador when I took them to task for the sleaziness, the sordidness of the legislation that they pushed through. He said, well, it was an act of parliament. It's the law of the United Kingdom. That doesn't mean that we have to accept it now as credible, simply because during a summer recess they were able to put the arm on people to push it through. I think it's a scandal, and when the British people are no longer afraid because they have their versions of crazed radio people and media just like we have here, when that fear subsides, I think that legislation will have another review.
Yeah. Apart from treatment of prisoners, are there any other aspects of the Iraqi or Afghanistan incursions that trouble you in terms of international law?
Well, certainly the declared grounds under which we went into Iraq, two declared grounds, and I just mentioned one of them, the alleged ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, were based on a confession derived from torture by one individual. Clearly that's out the window. And we now know, after exhaustive searches, there were no weapons of mass destruction, so the whole legal basis for going in, of course, is called into question. But what we have is what General Powell warned the administration about when there was the internal debate about going in, and it was the old saying, if you break it, you buy it. We're in there now. We broke it. And under international law, when you go in and take over a territory, which is exactly what they didn't want to do in the first Gulf War, and there were reasonable people in the senior President Bush's administration, including General Powell, who cautioned against going in because they didn't want to inherit the problems that Iraq had. But right now, we've been in there for as long as we have, and they still don't have electricity restored to the level that they had when the sanctions were imposed against Saddam Hussein. So you gotta wonder. Now, you hope against hope that democracy will take root. You hope against hope that the Iraqi army, which is in much better shape than the Iraqi police force, will have the credibility and loyalty of the people. But frankly, apart from the Kurdish units in the Iraqi army, you have maybe two battalions that are considered reliable and combat effective. What is the role going to be of Iran in stirring up the Shia? What are they doing to the Sunnis now? Even though the Sunnis, in a way, were like the Unionists in Northern Ireland, they dumped on the majority Shia since the Brits drew the line creating the country. We do have responsibilities, but the sooner we can get out of there, I think, the better we are.
This is not exactly an analogous situation, I know, but I just wonder, in terms of sort of retribution, what you think about the Truth and Reconciliation Council that was used in South Africa?
Applied in Northern Ireland?
That would be, I guess, the closest situation. And
When that was first proposed, and I think it was shortly after the Good Friday Agreement, it was poo-pooed, I think across the board almost. But as time goes on, you know, you had the Archbishop Eames and Dennis Bradley, and they made their report, a lot of flaws with it. And I think it's been rightly criticized by a number of people. But what has changed is that the underlying notion has gained far more acceptability. It certainly did wonders in South Africa. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, I think, was very farsighted in persuading the president at that time to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And despite what the skeptics might say, I think there's something very human, very fundamental about having a person who committed a terrible thing come to the victim, say, yes, I did that, and I was wrong. I think we may yet see something like it in Northern Ireland. I don't know if the society is yet firm enough planted, allow it to occur. I mean, the special branch guys who commissioned Pat Finucane's murder are still walking around. They could be still in uniform for all we know. So, and keep in mind too, Northern Ireland, as you know, is a very tiny, tiny place. When J. Edgar Hoover was FBI director for over four decades, he kept a private file cabinet in his office of dirt on just about everyone, and that's why he was able to stay director for over four decades. You have to believe that Special Branch has a similar file in Northern Ireland. So while the branch guys were involved in some of this dirt are still there, they have some de facto veto power. So it's going to take a little time for them to slip into their dotage before I think you can have a genuine truth and reconciliation panel. But I think it certainly would be curative on many different levels.
I read a poll a few days ago that said that more than half of all Americans approve of torture as a means of interrogation. And I was wondering whether you thought that was historically unusual, or whether you thought this was a unique moment in our history that most people would think that way?
Well, during warfare, during conflict, obviously people's emotions are stirred. But I think we are somewhat unique now that you have a public figure in the person of a vice president saying in slightly coded words that torture was justified, and is doing it with such enormous effect that a majority of people feel that way. But that's why the debate is so vital. We can't allow that to seep into an American culture as a viewpoint and a value that we accept. That has to be challenged.
But, I mean, how did we get to a point where we allowed Dick Cheney to trump George Washington?
There's only one explanation. It's the language of fear. There's something primordial in each one of us. And if we are told and we believe that we are in true danger, we are prepared to consider things that we would never consider if we didn't feel we were in mortal danger. Cheney was very effective upon playing on that fear factor. I think that's the only way you can get people to consider and to accept. How did the Germans, probably in their time, among the most civilized people, the most educated people on earth, how did they come to accept, certainly not initially, but accept by turning away from what Hitler was doing? He had convinced them what the Nazis were going to do, what the Jewish people were going to do. They had come through this terrible depression. Everything was taken. They were essentially stripped of that humanity that was part of their culture. And I think America has, through our wonderful mix, the greatest culture that has ever been known, where we've drawn the best from all people's cultures. Is this kind of practice something that is part of our nature? Not at all. But fear, repeated over and over again, can have a corrosive effect.
Yeah, but where was the disconnect or the breakdown where we didn't allow our resources and our assets to kind of bubble up? When some of the hawks in the administration wanted to sell, or when they turned to the CIA and said, all right, like as any leader would, like what are the tools you need to be successful? Why were the voices of like the head of the Sears School outside Fort Bragg, you know, the experts in the FBI in interrogation, like, who knew that it didn't work? Like, how come those voices didn't bubble to the surface and kind of override that hawkish ridiculousness?
They weren't permitted to. If you were still in the service, you could not speak out. That's why those of us who were retired, we knew what our colleagues still on active duty felt. Certainly the judge advocate generals right across the board. The two primary guys in our group are both former judge advocate generals of the Navy. But could they speak out when they were on active duty? Can't do it. And then if we knew something, I didn't, but if we knew something that was sensitive or classified, we can't reveal that.
You know, there were people that did speak out. There were people that did actually resign. There, you know, I know Anne, Colonel Anne White, 29 years in the military, gave her letter of resignation to Colin Powell and resigned in protest. So there were some people, and all of us were subjected to the same kind of propaganda of fear, and not all of us succumbed to it since 2001. Since the terrorist attacks, you know, here. So, you know, there were many people that withstood all this propaganda, and we had a media that was complicit. And it was really, a question is for all of us, like who we are, you know, as well as who they are. I mean, we know what they did in order, and we could look and deconstruct what they did in all these years to create a mass hysteria and a mass acceptance of the most heinous practices that took our Constitution and the Geneva Conventions apart and the UN Conventions against torture. And it's still happening. I mean, we're still in that. We're not done yet. There's no reconciliation. There's no prosecutions. We have a new Attorney General. They're still not bringing to justice the worst of the worst, who are the worst of the worst of us. We have the worst of the worst walking free right now and getting paid $150,000 to sit on a stage and talk, you know, nonsense. And Cheney still has the airwaves to continue the propaganda. He should be brought to justice.
I would mention that those who were on active duty at the time, you always have the view, well, if I just quit, now I lose the opportunity to work reform within the system. Because there were breaks put on, we have very, very good people in the JAG Corps and elsewhere who would not carry out this kind of stuff. You know, just like at Abu, at My Lai, it was a soldier who blew the whistle. It was a soldier who blew the whistle at Abu Ghraib. It was the Naval Criminal Investigative people who did a fantastic job, refused to put anything under the cover down at Guantanamo and elsewhere. And there is that view that, hey, you need to stay there to really work reform and make sure the craziness doesn't get out of hand. But I think you brought up another very good point. We can only react to what we know. And that's, you hope, the job of the Fourth Estate, of the press, to inform some of us. Now, those of us who have been in the military, yes, we had an obligation, especially when we retired, to speak out, and we did. We started in 2004, as soon as we became aware of what was occurring. But for the ordinary person who's going to their job every day, you read the paper, you look at the blog sites, and if they're not telling you what's going on, or if the information's being withheld from them and nobody really digs, but you know, in their defense, it was made to seem unpatriotic if a voice of criticism was raised. Yeah. And people succumbed to that too, just like good press did in Germany.
It was whistleblower Dante Brown who helped to break the case in the Finucane cover-up. How close are we realistically to getting an inquiry into his murder?
Well, I think the Conservatives are likely to win the next election. So while Maggie Thatcher and the people who control MI5, MI6 at that time are still alive, I think there's very little chance once the Conservatives come in government.
By then, though, by your own admission, a lot of the key players on the ground will also be dead.
Absolutely.
I mean, the main players have been, they've either quit accidentally and conveniently died.
Yes.
Or being killed.
Right. And with them...
Where does that leave us?
It leaves big evidentiary gaps, and that always plays into cover-ups. Delay, as I said, is the biggest tool in any cover-up. The more you can delay, the more people disappear. Your Honor.
Just Jim, didn't Judge Corey, when he spoke at the Brehon in New York, didn't he mention that he had released some of his findings to Pat Finucane's family and Rosemary Nelson? What has ever happened with that?
He did release some because he wanted to, the Brits were delaying releasing his findings of collusion. And he finally grew so frustrated when he realized what they were doing. Again, it was delay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Delay. And as he said to me, he says, they were hoping I would die first. So to advance that, he released what his summary of his findings. He could not, under the terms of his reference, release anything that had been designated as classified or sensitive. But he broke the logjam. They could no longer delay when he said, yes, I found evidence of collusion. That's enough torture. You guys have listened to me far enough. There's one more question.
One more question.
All right, Elizabeth.
I was just going to ask you, Jim, you know, by and large, the proceedings that we might hope to take place against various members of the Bush administration or Donald Rumsfeld or those things happen within a judicial process, which we have to currently rely on our elected government to pursue those. But beyond that, as a citizen actor in all of this, or what is it that other people could do outside this judicial and military process? Because you have these two processes, and to most citizens, the military process is completely opaque.
Mm-hmm. We try to make it that way. No. Only kidding. I think the public debate is ultimately going to compel the outcome. And what I see as the outcome is an investigation. Then the investigation takes you where the evidence leads. You know, if it turns out that somebody like David Addington, who was the Rasputin behind the scenes in much of this, is really a fine fellow and he was misjudged, well, okay, then that's fine. You know, at least you have a credible investigation. Call Fitzgerald out and have him do it, and then we'll be all satisfied. But until that time, the lack of resolution gives fuel to our enemies. Because when we get up and start preaching about democracy and the rule of law, they just laugh at us.
So do you think the military judicial process would be responsive to the citizenry getting noisy?
No, the military would not have jurisdiction over the civilian actors. And it was the civilian actors who directed all of this. It was, Addington was at the top of the heap. He was originally general counsel to Cheney and then became his chief of staff. And when you look down the line, William J. Haynes III, the Defense Department chief counsel, these were all guys operating under Addington. The military has no jurisdiction. So you have to have an attorney general appointing, typically a special investigator. And then you let them, the evidence goes where it leads. Okay, it's time for a drink. This bartender.